Okay, so Sunday is a medrash. Let's learn some medrash from Parshas Fukas. Okay. Vayiru kol ha'ida ki gava aharon. What does it mean? They saw that he died. Obviously, they saw. Torah doesn't have to document their optical response. Vayigva aharon, vayamas aharon. Everyone was there, saw. So what happened was, Moshe and Aaron came down from the cave when he passed away. And they said, where's Aaron? Amru lo. Amulam Moshe told him, Mace, he died. How could the Malchamavis possibly affect Aaron? He was such a tzaddik. Not only was he such a tzaddik, but he was the one that battled against the Malchamavis in Parshas Korach, when there was a plague, and he stopped the Malchamavis dead in his tracks. So he told Moshe, if you bring us Aaron's dead body, then we'll be right. If not, we're going to stone you. No, were they going to stone Moshe? Did they suspect foul play? The Moshe killed Aaron? Were they just angry at Moshe? What's the language? We're going to stone you, Moshe and Elazar. So Moshe davens Hashem, and Ribbono Shel Olam, please lift their suspicion from me. They suspect me of murdering Aaron, of hiding Aaron, of dispatching Aaron away. Miad pasach HaKadosh Baruch Hu Samara. Hashem opens the cave. There, O Lahem. And he shows them the dead body of Aaron. Shenemar. So this is a backstory we don't have. They can't believe that Aaron's dead. They suspect Moshe of foul play, maybe, of kidnapping Aaron. And Hashem has to intervene and show them the body of Aaron that is really dead and that Moshe had no hand in it. It was a regular body. It wasn't disfigured or vandalized in any way. It wasn't attacked in any way. What's happening here? It's not really the suspicion of Moshe. It's not like they, at this point, continue to suspect Moshe. This isn't Korach part 2 or part 3 in Parshas Chukas. This is the beginning of the end. This is when that leadership from the first generation is about to pass on. And when you have such superhuman leadership, you can't imagine them ever dying. You can't imagine what the world would be like. First of all, you can't imagine that they'd be dead because they're larger than life in your mind and they're beyond death. And second of all, the alternative is too catastrophic. So in your mind, you spin these make-believe stories. Well, they're not really dead because you can't imagine. I remember waking up into the world without Rav Soloveitchik. I couldn't imagine how the world could survive without Rav Soloveitchik. I couldn't imagine how I would survive without Rav Lichtenstein. Yom HaSez in Ksuvos and Lef Kuf Dalet. When Rebbe passed away, imagine Rebbe was one of the titans of the Masora. He's responsible for Torah Shabbat Peh. And when Rebbe died, they made an announcement, Kol HaOmer Rebbe Mace. If anyone says that Rebbe's dead, Yidaker Becherev, he should be stabbed. They weren't going around stabbing kids who said that, but it was a deterrent that people shouldn't mention it too often, because it was just too crushing. It was too painful. So it's like if we don't talk about it, we'll resuscitate and resurrect Rebbe, but some things you're better off not speaking about it. You don't talk about it because it causes too much pain. And here you see them going through those difficult times, and something that a lot of people go through at different stages in life. And when the Rebbe passed away, it was traumatic for the world, but certainly for people who were Hasidim of his in the direct sense. And this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's lessoning to the Jewish people. It's going to happen again with Moshe, but we're not going to see the post-mortem with Moshe because he's going to die in the end of the Torah. We're not going to see what's going to happen afterwards, but we'll see the life goes on. There are struggles. No one is irreplaceable. Anytime you hear that someone's irreplaceable, if other people are saying it, they're wrong, and the person himself is saying it's narcissistic. The world goes on, and people go on. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to continue. We may have greater challenges. People have to rise to the occasion to replace them. But this is their first. Man, Miriam's death was much more private. Aaron's death was, everyone saw Moshe, Aaron and Elazar walking up to the cave together. And this is their trying to wrap their heads on what it means to have great leaders die. But great leaders die, and they move on. And you see, even in our own Masara, people have a hard time handling that and create ways to hang on. It's important to hang on, but it's also important to move forward even from great people. Okay, that's number one. Number two is, after Aaron dies, so Kenani, the king of Arad, who lives in the south, hears about Aaron's death and feels this is a chance for him to intercede and for the Jews are vulnerable. Now, Mizahaya Melech Arad, who is this king of Arad? Ze Amalek. Shenemar Amalek Yoshev Eretz HaNegev Vechiti Vairusi Vermar Yoshev Bahar. After all, in Parshat Shlach, we know who lived on the southern flank of Israel. It was Amalek. So this is a king of Arad in the south of Israel. must really be Amalek. So if he's Amalek, why is he called Kenani? So Rashi says, the Medr says, because he tried to confuse the Jewish people. They're really Amaleks, but the Jews were ready for Amalek. So what happened was, he told his armies to speak Canaanite. So the Jews would think they're battling Canaanite, but really they're battling Amalekis, and he's going to overcome them in that way. Now, what his plan was, why the Jews would be more vulnerable if they think they're fighting Canaan rather than Amalek, probably psychological. Even though they were afraid of Amalek, because of everything that had happened in Parshat Bishlach, they had a vengeance, they had an axe to grind with Amalek, so they possibly would have, with Canaanite, maybe they would have been less prepared, or they weren't riled up yet against Canaan. With Amalek, this was their sworn enemy. But what's fascinating about this is twofold. Number one, is that this is the first time Amalek embarks on a brave new plan. Who is Amalek? Amalek is Eliphaz's son, which means he's Esav's grandson. The Medrash says that before Eliphaz, before Amalek's stepmother passed away, her name was Timnah, so it was his stepmother. So before he was Pelegash of Eliphaz, before Eliphaz's stepwife, Amalek's stepmother passed away, she called Amalek into her room and she said, "You're the one." I mean, you're the one. You're the one that has to reverse the tragedy of history. What was the tragedy of history? That Yaakov swiped the firstborn and the legacy for Esav. It's going to be your job to try to reverse that. That's why Amalek picks his timing very carefully. Namely, Amalek's timing is when it's the first time Amalek tries to reverse it. Right when we're about to enter Eretz Yisrael and receive the Torah, in Parshas Bishlach, it was the original plan to enter Eretz Yisrael right after the Torah, Amalek tries to intercede to prevent us achieving Jewish legacy. If we receive the Torah, then our selection will be more advanced. They've got to try to stem Matan Torah. They fail. When's the next time Amalek rears his head aside from this Parsha? When we start to achieve Jewish monarchy in Sefer Shmuel. When Shaul is now the king, and now we're heading on the road to monarchy, heading on the road to sovereignty, heading on the road to Beis HaMikdash, they've got to intercede. So Amalek picks and chooses their times very carefully. Haman picks and chooses his time very carefully. We're about to return to Eretz Yisrael. It's an 18-year pocket. So Amalek is not just this vicarious, capricious nation just looking to cause trouble for the Jewish people. They always want to enter these very, very delicate stages of history to inhibit the advance of Jewish history. Now, what about today? I mean, you don't see really Amalek. There's no one people. There's probably no mitzvah to murder or to eliminate Amalek because we don't really know the genealogy. So we talk about Amalek, we wouldn't have Amalek anymore. The answer is at some point in history, Amalek changed their strategy. When they tried to attack the Jewish people and they consistently failed, they had to try different strategy. The different strategy was to weaponize other nations and to work through them. So instead of just attacking us in the desert, instead of just warring with us as they did in Shmuel, they would work, as we would say, behind the scenes or through other international vehicles and other empires to try to collude against the Jewish people. Now you see this most directly in the Haman story. Who are we really battling in Haman? Are we really battling Amalek? Are we battling Paras? And Paras isn't this neutral kingdom. They're one of the four Malchios. They're one of the four empires that threaten Jewish history. It's Bavel, Paras and Madai, Yavon and Edom. So this is not just some side country that happens to be possessed by Amalek. This is, we have a battle with Paras, and the battle continued even afterwards. So who's our real battle, with Paras or with Haman as the representative of Amalek? The answer is, this is Haman switching the strategy. This is Haman choosing a whole new strategy on behalf of Amalek. That Amalek will try, we could call it in our terms, anti-Semitism, because there isn't one basis of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism works through different narratives, works through different people, through different groups. So this is the seed of trying to destroy the Jewish people and to undo Jewish selection. It's not one nation coming to confront us, but it has become a force or a culture or a narrative that then starts to infect many, many other nations. You see the first embryo of that in Parshas Chukas, where Amalek makes believe there are different people. So we don't think we're fighting Amalek, we're fighting some other nation, but we're really fighting Amalek. This is not the full-blown strategy of Haman. This is not the full-blown strategy of Hitler. This is the full-blown strategy of... This is the start of that shift, where Amalek is not going to confront us on the battlefield head-on. They're going to make believe there are different people. And that has become Amalek's weapon, Amalek's strategy throughout history. So we're starting to see history unfold in Parshas Chukas. Now, what's also interesting about this is that Amalek, Hashem says you should fight with Amalek, but don't fight B'nai Esav, the Medrash says. And to a degree, that's why it was easier for the Jews to defeat them, because they were Kenani if they had been a Amalek, they may have been a little confused, because wait a second, we're supposed to destroy a Amalek. But Al Tiskor Bam, as the Pasuk says in Devarim, Parak Beis, we're not supposed to fight Edom, we're not supposed to provoke Edom, we're not supposed to be antagonistic to Edom. Far more tender than we're even supposed to treat Mitzrayim or Ammon or Moab. So, wait a second. Esav, Edom, Amalek, what's the split? The answer is, this is really important. I wrote about it for next week's Torah Tidbits, if you're reading that article. It's really important. There are two parts to Esav. There's the Amalek part to Esav, metaphorically. Then there's the Edom part of Esav. And the Edom part of Esav still can be redeemed and still can become our partner. And to a degree, throughout history, we're watching the redemption of Edom, the redemption of Esav. What has happened to Esav? What did we want from Esav? We wanted Esav to be our partner. We wanted Esav, that's where he came to in Parshas Chukas, and we said, right after the war with Amalek, the notorious part of Edom, we went to Edom and we reminded him, we're brothers, Avosenu Yarda leMitzrayim, we were in Mitzrayim, we shouldered the burden of history. That burden is because we were supposed to represent Hashem. You grew up in the house of Yitzchak. You know what monotheism is. You know what morality is. We took one on the chin for you. Now join us. At the very least, let us come into Eretz Yisrael. Be part of us achieving history. Maybe you won't be as inside to history as we will, but you'll be part of the historical process by enabling the Jews to enter Eretz Yisrael. Edom says, no. So what should we do? Eliminate them. What does Hashem say? Hold off. I'll discard them. Why? Because there still is hope for Edom. And throughout history, there still will be hope for Edom. What have we seen over the last 2,000 years? Well, in the year 400, Edom, Christianity, or Western civilization, became Christian. Rome, the descendant of Edom, turned to monotheism. That's not pure monotheism. It's still monotheism that's laden with a lot of paganism, but it's far superior in the ancient paganism of worshipping oceans and skies and animals and feces and mushrooms. This is the march towards monotheism. This is Christianity historically is a tragedy for the Jews because it leads to such bloodshed. But conceptually, if you separate the two conceptually, it's moving humanity closer to monotheism. So all of a sudden, Esav becomes a little bit more redeemed. What happens in the 15th century, 16th century, the Renaissance period? All of a sudden, Western civilization looks back at 1,000 years of the Dark Age and says, we have to be more moral. We have to build a better society. We have to build democracy. We have to build equality. We can't live in a world in which the power is concentrated amongst the few, and those few abuse their power and murder people. And all of a sudden, the last 300-400 years, Western civilization has created a more civil society, a more moral society. People aren't being beheaded. People aren't being chopped up into pieces. People aren't being enslaved. Again, this aggression of morality in other areas because of democracy. Democracy is a funny thing. It's a more moral way to live together. But by choosing a more moral way to live together, it creates certain personal moral challenges. Moral subjectivism, multiculturalism, identity politics. I mean, it's a scary thing, but in general, we've created a better moral society. What happened in 1965? Christianity officially banned anti-Semitism. That whole narrative that Jews were responsible for killing Jesus, and go, all of a sudden, Christianity officially isn't meant to be anti-Semitic anymore. And of course, the final test of Edom is many parts of Edom are helping us return to Eretz Yisrael. In 1947, the UN voted to return the Jewish people to the land of Israel. Over the last 70 years, a lot of support has come from Christian circles. So evidently, there are two parts of Edom. Hashem will judge Edom in the end of days, and that judgment will select between the Amalek parts of Edom, who are continually bent on Jewish destruction, and those people will be disciplined, as opposed to the redeemed parts of Edom that are going to be part of history, and they're going to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu clearly, and their monotheism will be purged of all paganism, let's see Hashem, and let's see the Jewish people. So you see this split happening in Parshas Chukas, where Amalek has to be fought ferociously, but Edom, not so much. And you're starting to see the split of history in Chukas. Chukas is a very, very important book of history. You see a lot of historical patterns beginning to unfold. Chukas and Balak in particular, history, Gula. Korach's very internal. Chukas and Balak are very international. A lot of interaction with the Amaleks, the Canaanites, the Edoms, the Sichons, the Ogs, the Balaks, the Bilams. So there's a dramatic shift between the tone of Shlach and Korach and the tone of Balak and Pinchas, Chukas, Balak, Pinchas. Okay, stop here. Have a good day, everyone. Good morning. Kalakavod. Kalakavod.